It's Stokely and Zach on Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan.
So let's just spin it forward here for a brief moment. We were having a conversation about Vance Joseph and the threshold for him to keep his job, and it really got inspired. It got inspired by, you know, me driving down the road really home yesterday and listening to the guys deal with that fire alarm. There's a fire alarm going off at the beginning of their show, and watching them try to navigate it was, or listening to them try to navigate it, rather, was pretty funny. But a caller called in and said, hey, what's the over-under? If I said Vance Joseph lasting as head coach of the Broncos 8 games, would you take the over-under? And this is what D-Mac said.
I'll take the under. Yeah, I'll say even at 3-3, I think he gets canned. Chad?
I'll go over.
So D-Mac said even 3-3, Vance will get fired. Then we spun it forward. We just bounced it off Sandy. And, of course, you, Troy Rank, filling in for Brandon Stokely today. You said 4-5, you could see it. 4-5, you could see it. That would be heading into the bye, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Correct.
That would
be after the Houston game, November 4th.
Yep, and that would be ahead of visiting the Chargers in the middle of the month of November. If that were to happen, okay, let's just get pessimistic and negative for a second, for a brief moment. And before we continue, I just want to make clear, I don't think this is going to happen. I don't think the Broncos will be under 500 by the bye. That's just me. Reasonable minds can disagree. So that's just me stating for myself. Troy, if Vance did get fired going into that bye week, who's coaching this football team taking the Broncos to Los Angeles to play the Chargers?
Well, again, speculation will center on Gary Kubiak, especially if he's around more during the season. I mean, he's an advisor. He's, again, I love the fact he's more involved because he's the one guy I've seen in over the last few years that can agree to disagree with John Elway, maintain the relationship, maintain the job, frankly.
That's a good point, by the way.
And John respects him, but Gary Kubiak's won a Super Bowl. His coaching acumen is proven, and he'd be around. But I know, again, his family would not want him to do that. There's a reason he stepped away. He left a football field in an ambulance twice as a head coach. Those were serious health issues. I mean, the one was, you know, essentially in Houston, a mini stroke. The second one wasn't. It was more of a complex migraine, but some of the symptoms were similar. Very scary stuff. So it's easy to say, well, Kubiak's there, obviously be Kubiak. Again, I would be surprised if his family would want him to venture back into that role. Garrett, Bill Musgrave would be the next one. I would not see Joe Woods as a candidate at all to be the head coach. I mean, at that point, as a young defensive coordinator, a lot of times he's the special teams guy because it keeps the coordinators in place. When Gary Kubiak had to step aside and they went with Joe D, the special teams coach.
So you don't think Joe Woods would be a candidate to take over this team, despite being the defensive coordinator?
I do not. No. I mean, he's got to prove it. I mean, he's in a prove it year just as much as Vance is.
Well, the hilarious part about this thing, and I don't know if hilarious is the right word to describe it, but Joe Woods at this point has as much experience as Vance did when Vance got hired.
He does.
I mean, think about that.
And would be even more a reason why they wouldn't go in the same spot. You know what I mean? Like you just said, that didn't work. Why would you then, you know, the definition of insanity, why would you then do it again with a defensive coordinator who's, you know, halfway through his second season? So Bill Musgrave would be the guy that profiles. He's been around the league forever. He's been a quarterback. He's never really shown the interest to be a head coach. That's not been like his driving force goal in life, from what I've been told. He likes being a coordinator. He's been really good at being a coordinator. But again, we're playing a hypothetical game. If Gary Kubiak's around, the speculation will center on him because of his acumen, because of his reputation, and every reason. You'd have to know where that health situation set at that point. How would it be different now, 2 years later, year and a half later, for him from a health standpoint? Because I know that was a huge, huge issue for him on stepping away from the fire. Like to get healthy and live a quality long life. You have to remember, he's in his 50s when this was happening. It wasn't like he was, you know, 68, 72,
right,
having major health issues. He was in his 50s, who was in good shape.
I mean, how old is he now? 54 or something like that?
Yeah, I think he's probably 55, 56.
Excuse me, 56. 56.
Yeah, again, 56, having left 2 NFL games by ambulance.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a scary thing, especially a guy who's in pretty good shape. Like, it's not like, you look at him and go, oh, man, because that year, his last year as the head coach, he was aging in dog years. I mean, he just looked gaunt, and he physically was taking it out of him because he needed to step away, but he couldn't stop working. He's only wired one way. That's the reason I don't know how it would work. Gary Kubiak's wired to work 18 hours, 20 hours a day as a head coach. Had he been able to delegate and say, I'll work 10, I probably could be a head coach, but that's not him. It's never been him. Gary Kubiak is a grinder by nature, and as a head coach, you have so many things you can do that the day there aren't enough hours in the day. You come back as a coordinator, there are only so many things you can do. You know, but when you're the head coach, your day never ends.
So throw up, and again, this is an arbitrary conversation. I'm going to ask you to just sort of pin the tail on the donkey. Give me a probability. If Vance Joseph was fired in the scenario that you said, 4-5, heading into the bye, the odds that Gary Kubiak takes over, like so many others have suggested, I see it right now in front of me on the text line. Why do you think that Gary Kubiak's around for? He's obviously plan B, that type of sentiment. What are the odds that Gary Kubiak would take over?
I would say it's less than, I would put it at, let's say 30%, only because he doesn't want that. He is here to support Vance Joseph, not to undermine him. If you know anything about Gary Kubiak, he's loyal. He's as good a person as I've ever covered in sports. There's no nefarious thing going on behind the scenes. So the idea that he would even think of that is, for me, would shock me, because Gary Kubiak is a good person, a good man, a man of character. He's here in part, not just to help John Elway, to try to elevate Vance Joseph, that he's got a mentor in-house now that he can bounce things off without feeling like, am I bouncing? If you're bouncing it off Mike McCoy last year, you know, who are you bouncing it off of? You know, that. So I just don't see it. I get the call. I get the sentiment, but I don't see it. I just don't see Gary Kubiak having any interest in doing that again. But I never say never in the NFL, ever.
Well, I'm with you. You put it at 30%. I think it's less than half that. I think it'd be Bill Musgrave sort of story writes itself from there. But there is a thought out there that it could be. It could be Gary Kubiak. Hopefully, for the Broncos' sake, that's not even... That's not up for a real possibility, because you're not 4-5 at that break. All right, this is fascinating. You guys got to hear this. ESPN experts made 25 predictions about the NFL between now and the year 2021. Only one prediction involved the Broncos, and it was a doozy. You got to hear it. It's next.
Come on. You know I got you. Yeah. One.
ESPN experts made 25 predictions about the NFL between now and the year 2021. Very interesting here. Only one of the 25 predictions, Troy, involved the Denver Broncos, but it was a doozy. Once again, Troy Rank filling in for Brandon Stokely today on Stokely and Zach. Did you see this, Troy? Did you happen to come across this piece? 25 predictions over the next 3 years?
I saw some of it, not all of it. So I did not see the part that pertained to the Broncos. I just saw on Twitter fans reacting with the piece, but I didn't see the entire piece. So enlighten me.
Yeah, let's go through it. It says, quote, at least two more teams will be sold. The Carolina Panthers just sold for $2.275 billion. That price tag alone is enough to grab the attention of any owner who has even considered the idea of getting out. The unfortunate health situation with the current ownership of the Denver Broncos makes that team the most obvious candidate to be the next one sold. And then in parentheses, check this out, Troy. Watch to see whether Peyton Manning is involved when that happens. End parenthesis. It's obviously hard to predict situations like that, or like the one that forced the aforementioned Panther sale, but the Tennessee Titans have a situation to which many around the league are paying attention to on this front, end quote. What do you think about the Broncos being sold in the next 3 years? Is that a scenario that you can realistically forecast?
I do not see that. They've got five-year deals with the trust. Obviously, the goal from, you know, when I've talked to sources on this issue, they would prefer it be Brittany Bowlen. She would need to age. I mean, she's not yet 30. There's no way she's taking over a $2.6 billion business at 29 years old. That's not happening. But because of the NFL's confidence in the way they've run it so far financially, attendance-wise. I mean, yeah, they had a bad season last year, but the history and legacy of the Broncos really means a lot to the NFL. So basically, they kind of leave them alone. There's no sense of urgency here. Now, again, if Beth Bolin were to push this in court and challenge the trust and try to get resolution during the season or something along that regard, and the NFL finally looks up and goes, hey, enough. Like, we're tired of seeing this story in the headlines every other week. Now we're talking about litigation. Then, yeah, there is a scenario, a pathway to where that could happen. I don't see it right now. But there is that possibility if Beth Bolin Wallace, as she has to this point, she's advocated for her candidacy, and she could get to the point where she challenges the trust, the trust and the legitimacy of the trust and the three person, and are they kind of self-interest, self-motivated? And if she takes it to court and starts challenging documents, we're playing a hypothetical game here. That's when the NFL hates distractions. They hate bad news. So that's when that's somewhere in that prediction, they're seeing a scenario where the NFL goes, hey, we left you alone for the better part of 4 or 5 years, but now enough. Like, we need resolution.
Do you, in your gut, do you think that's the direction that this situation will ultimately trend? That Beth Bolin says, you want to know what's been happening here isn't fair. She's already gave you indications that she could step up in a litigious way. Do you think that it ultimately ends up in court?
I do think that it does. That's just a prediction. That's not a story I'm writing.
No,
I'm predicting that can happen. That I see that as a possibility, yes. That some point during the season, she's getting nowhere with this situation, and she has the wherewithal, she has the finances to challenge it and say, you know what, I just think this is dramatically unfair. I'm qualified in her mind based on some of the rubrics that we have not seen all of them, but she believes she certainly has her law degree. She's a sibling, and she's of age, obviously more of age than Brittany. So would I be surprised if it ended up in litigation? I would not. And that's where it gets greasy, where the NFL could go, say, we trust you and this will go away, or they'll say, enough. We don't want to deal with this anymore. You guys need to figure it out.
So that's
they play by their own rules. The NFL, it's so arbitrary. Some teams, they're like, you got to get this taken care of. You're an embarrassment. Other teams, like legacy franchises, they basically let them do whatever they want. And they play by their own rules until, again, there's some kind of distraction or embarrassment or bad publicity for the league. Then typically you see a sense of urgency from the league. Right now, there's no sense of urgency from the league. They're perfectly content with the way Joe Ellis and the trust have handled this to this point.
I did hear that the league called the Broncos during the back and forth. I did hear that. Now, I'm not telling you that for 100% certainty happened, but a guy that you and I both trust, and I'm not going to say who it is right now on the air, but I have it on pretty good information that the league did place a call and said, hey, just want to know what's going on and get on the same page, because you're right. The thing that the NFL doesn't like is a distraction, especially with a legacy brand like the Denver Broncos. And when it comes to going back to the question of, is Beth Bolin going to eventually take this to court? Whether or not she ends up victorious from that, or whatever victory looks like for her, I'm not sure. But it may be the thing that spurs the NFL to then say, okay, guys, we have to come to a resolution. You know, in one way or another, we can't keep going down this road. And I could absolutely see that happening. You know, ESPN experts saying in the next 3 years, I could absolutely see that happening.
Well, there's an avenue to where if litigation becomes a reality, then there would certainly be an avenue as to that happening. An ideal world, a family member takes over for me. A family member takes over and continues Pat Bolin's legacy of excellence, and cares as much as he cared, wants to win as much as he wants to win. I mean, when we talk about Hall of Fame owners, and he will, for me, he'll get voted in finally, and it's way overdue.
Is this the year?
This is the year.
I can't see
a scenario in which he doesn't. But as pro sports owners go, it's hard to beat the way he ran it. Give you all the resources, spend money on the players, spend money on the product, and don't meddle. How many guys, even if your owner that you like meets the first of spend money, want to win, compete, a lot of them meddle. Pat Bolin he would get involved eventually and be like, okay, be kind of, but he trusted the people he hired, let them do their jobs, and he created, again, I covered the team when he was at his height of his power. You walked in there and there was a sense of excellence. Like the guy getting the coffee better get it right. The guy getting the carpet clean, you better get it right. Like that's when they say excellence in every way and every part of the organization. And that's sometimes what, like last year was lost, whether it was the rookie class, whether it was some of the coaches. Pat Bowlen established a legacy that when you showed up to work today, you better give it your best effort or you're going to be called out on it. And for me, that's what made him a great owner. He will be a Hall of Famer. But again, for me in an ideal scenario, I'd like to see a family member take over and care as much as he did. I just don't know right now. I can't sit here and forecast that. That's certainly, there's some uncertainty there.
Yeah, I don't think any of us can really. We just got to hang out and watch and continue to monitor it. Shout out to Cecil Lammy, who's turned into a great friend of mine. This guy's one of the hardest workers there is. He's having a fantasy draft party Sunday, August 27th at the DoubleTree DTC. Let me say that again. Cecil Lammy's fantasy draft party. This guy's a fantasy savant. It's going to be Sunday, August 27th at the DoubleTree DTC. Question and answer with Cecil from 1 to 3 p.m. Then he'll be on hand for your draft from 3 to 7. Food and draft board are included. It's just $15 per person. Register at 1043thefan.com. You're going to have a fantasy draft anyway, right? You and the boys? Might as well do it at DoubleTree DTC with Cecil Lammy. Troy, have we jumped to conclusions about the Broncos' rival? We have an update with the Raiders that may cause for concern. We'll dive into it next. Troy, have we jumped to conclusions about one of the Broncos' rivals? And, of course, I'm talking about the Raiders. There has been a sentiment, and please jump in and correct me if I'm wrong. There has been a sentiment, once again, Troy Rank filling in for Stoke today. There's been a sentiment surrounding the Raiders that they are moving in the wrong direction, despite hiring Gruden. And it's sort of contrary to like the direction that I thought the conversation would go. There seems to be a negative sentiment surrounding John Gruden and the Raiders. And even to you know, peel back the onion another layer, more specifically, it's, you know, how is Derek Carr going to get coached hard by John Gruden? This is a millennial quarterback, young guy, and now you're going to have this, you know, quote-unquote Chucky persona, you know, in his face on a day-to-day basis. Well, yesterday, Derek Carr was on the Jim Rome show, and the report from Carr about his relationship with Gruden is the furthest thing from what you would hear from the narrative. Quote, everything I dreamed of and thought about him, it's been all that and then some. We are so similar. It's so funny. When he was going to be a coach, the number one question was like, how are you guys going to get along? And both of us would just sit there and laugh together. We love football. We want to win. We love to compete. We love to demand from one another. I demand from him. He demands from me. I'm in his ear every day. What do you have for me today? What are you teaching me today? And he's in there pushing me. I can compete in practice and go 30 for 31. And we'll spend an hour talking about that one I missed and how it can be the difference in a game. And that's exactly how I want it. End quote. Not necessarily the, you know, master and, you know, subservient young player. We're seeing these guys, according to these quotes, Troy, in conjunction with one another. How do you view the Raiders?
Again, I didn't see that as the issue. I mean, Gruden working with quarterbacks, as he's been away from the game for what feels like, what, a decade, he's been working with quarterbacks with his QB show. I mean, he still breaks down film. I didn't see the coaching of Derek Carr as being any issue. That is Carr's health is an issue for me. His back injury, he wasn't the same after he got hurt against Denver last year. The issue for me is defensively they have multiple holes. Can he and Marshawn Lynch get along, Gruden and Lynch? That, for me, is a fair question.
That's an interesting one.
And how do you go from, you know, the ESPN booth where, where it's easy to have the answers as an analyst to coaching a team that has clear holes where the expectation is you're the Belichick of football because they paid him $100 million. And if you looked at Gruden's last 4 or 5 years of his career, he was basically a 500 NFL coach.
Yeah, even less, really.
And I like him as an analyst, and I like John Gruden. I do. But I just look at their roster, and wonder how just a coach is going to make a difference. It's not college where you coach them up, so per se. You know what I mean? Like, I just look at that roster, Zach. They're older. I joke and call them Centrum Silver and Black, but they're older at key positions. They've got, you know, Donald Penn. There's questions there now. Marshawn Lynch, clearly on the other side of his career. You bring in Jordy Nelson. I like that acquisition, but defensively, they have question marks. And Khalil Mack's unhappy because he wants a new deal. He is by far your best defensive player, if not your best player. There's just a lot going on around him, and they're going to be leaving Oakland. So if it gets ugly early there, how are the fans going to respond to that? Well, knowing they're leaving. It's
good
not,
question.
Not a question of will they leave. They are leaving to Las Vegas. So all those factors involved make me think it's going to be hard for them to be a playoff team. There's just a lot going on. But the least of my worries if I'm a Raiders fan is Carr coaching – dealing with Gruden's coaching. I think Carr wants to be great. And if you want to be great, you want to be coached. I just look at the roster and say, I don't see the answers defensively right now.
So if I ask you, and I have it written down here in our notes, you know, which version of the Raiders do you think you'll see? The 12-win team from 2016 or the 6-win team from 2017? Sounds like you're closer to 17.
17. I think, again, they're a 6-7-win team right now. Again, and the Broncos could be right there with them. I'm not sitting here saying I'm bullish on the Broncos. I have the Broncos, again, it's around 8-8 with a chance to get in the playoffs that last 2-3 weeks of the season. There's a couple of swing games for the Broncos. But I see the Raiders much closer to the last season than 2 years ago.
Well, real quick, in terms of your referencing John Gruden in his last couple years as a head coach, if you look at the subsequent years following the Super Bowl, right? He won the Super Bowl with the Bucs in 2002. That was his first season with the Bucs. They were a 12-14 that win the Super Bowl. It's all good. The next year, they're a 7-9 football team. The following year, they're a 5-11 football team. Now, the following year in 2005, the Bucs under John Gruden were 11-5. Okay, but they lose their first playoff game. The year after that, they drop from 11-5 to 4-12. The next season, 9-7. The next season, 9-7. And then not long after that, John Gruden's up in the booth for Monday Night Football. So really, lackluster following the Super Bowl. And the 1 year that they did have when they were 11-5, they make it to the playoffs and they lose their first playoff game. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see. But I'm not so sure there's a more fascinating coaching watch league-wide right now than watching John Gruden. Because John Gruden's a star. I mean, make no mistake, John Gruden is a star. And even without having been coaching in the last decade, he may be, outside of Bill Belichick, the second most recognizable coach in football, despite not being on the sidelines in a decade.
Well, there's no question. I mean, he's a superstar. You see what reality TV does for everyone.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a fixture. Everyone knows who John Gruden is, and everyone knows his football knowledge. But it's different from being an analyst to then going back to a game you haven't been at really in a decade and winning. You know, winning. When he walked into Tampa Bay, that roster was Tony Dungy's roster, and he took it to the next step, to his credit. But that wasn't – he didn't build that up. And with the Raiders, they could never get back over the hump. And we'll see. We'll see. I have questions about the Raiders defensively. And if Mac's unhappy and he has any kind of drop-off, now they're in big trouble because he, by far, is their best defensive player.
Real quick, do you hear that Brent Musburger?
Brent.
Is going to be the voice of the Raiders here for the next couple of years? Signed a three-year contract.
3 years?
Three-year contract.
So he does the shows out of Vegas now, the gambling shows, because mm-hmm. I've been on a couple of them when the Rockies playoffs of all times. I don't know, just talking game. It wasn't talking gambling because I don't gamble. But, yeah, I mean, I've met Brett a number of times. I can't – three-year deal, though.
It's a little longer duration than I thought he'd be willing to sign up for.
But he is based in Vegas.
But he is based in Vegas. And you know what? I'm sure listening to one of those games, he's going to tell you when each prop bet is hit along the way. You know, and that makes for a fun broadcast. Just keep away from the Bills and A.J. McCarron. If he steps on the field, he's going to be flashing to his wife. Could the worst fears be coming true for one of Denver's brightest hopes of the future? I tell you what we're talking about when we come back. Could the worst fears be coming true for one of Denver's brightest hopes of the future? Not sure if you heard this yet. We have learned here in the last 24 hours that forward Michael Porter Jr.,
who slid to Denver at number 14 in the NBA draft, of course, within this past month. Due to ongoing back issues, had another surgery this last week. His camp believes that his latest surgery, his latest procedure, will be the breakthrough of his herniated disc problems. It's not his team's plan to have him sit out the entirety of the 2018-19 season. But, Troy, this is the very last thing that you wanted to hear of a guy who's been dealing with back injury, back surgery, and now here we are again. Hearing that this happened again just this past week.
Well, it paints a picture, a grim picture of him playing this season, and that's unfortunate. Again, I saw Michael Porter play in high school, loved the talent. Last year at Mizzou was a lost season. He played essentially, what, two games, a game and a half?
Yeah.
And he felt like there was some kind of weird misdiagnosis of the back there, whatever. If it were any other injury, I'd feel a little better. Back injuries are nothing to joke about. I mean, they can be career-threatening, even at his age, which he's barely, what, 20, if 20?
Yeah.
So I'm concerned. I like the pick. I put the caveat, you know, kind of if healthy, but I'm not going to back away from it because of the talent and what was available there. I mean, it's a huge, you know, huge upside pick, but a second surgery on a back, that is problematic. So I would suggest, based on what happened last year at Missouri, he set this entire year out, focused at, just as Ben Simmons did with the foot that year with the with the Sixers. Use it as a redshirt year in the pros. Get your strength right. Get everything right so you can come back as a second-year player, healthy and productive. Don't rush back to the court because we've seen that doesn't help him. And start looking, take the macro view of this if you're Michael Porter Jr. Because the micro view of trying to get him back on the floor has not worked. And then if you he comes back and has to have any kind of third procedure, then you're talking career threatening for me. You're talking about he's already had multiple back surgeries, and he's barely 20. So use this as your Ben Simmons year. Get right, get healthy, and come back productive.
Yeah, and the fact that you just saw a player of his caliber, Ben Simmons, pretty fair equivalent when you talk about both of their projections coming out of high school. This sucks. I mean, we knew that it was – we could be looking at likely a redshirt year. We knew that. We didn't know that he was going to have another surgery. Okay, now this is his second surgery on his back in less than a year, performed by Dr. Andrew Doucette of the Carroll Clinic in Dallas, Texas. The thing for me is Michael Porter Jr. can't make the same mistake twice. You referenced it. He came back at the end of the season at Missouri.
He made no sense.
Should have never done that. It didn't make any sense. You're right, Troy. I mean, not one speck of sense. You were not going to regain the value that was lost in terms of the preseason number one in the NBA draft projection for Michael Porter Jr. That was never coming. It wasn't coming back, and you weren't going to win it all back in the SEC tournament, of all things. He can't make that same mistake twice. He just can't do it.
No, because if you make that mistake twice, that could lead to a third back surgery,
right,
which could be spelled doom for his career. Get it right. Get it strong. Get it. Make sure you take every precaution. There's no timeline, no calendar. We respond to symptoms. We don't need you back by April. We don't need you back. And again, that hurts. And I'm one who advocated picking him given where they were in the draft. But
yeah, of course.
You can't have him come back in April and have a setback and go, what are we doing here?
And what you do then when you come back and you come back too early is other things get hurt.
Absolutely.
And that's what happened leading up to the draft. He dealt with a hip strain. Then he started to deal with spasms. That's what happens when you come back prematurely. It should not be the case. And I believe that it shouldn't be up to Michael Porter Jr. I believe that the Denver Nuggets need to step up organizationally and actually put this thing to bed before it gets started. Because then you eliminate the expectation and you eliminate the Michael Porter Jr. watch, if you will. I think Tim Connelly steps forward and says, we have decided organizationally that there's a precedent. We just saw Ben Simmons do it, and we're going to do it with Michael Porter Jr. Don't expect to see Michael Porter Jr. in a game uniform this season. And just put the whole thing to bed and treat him next year. Treat him next year in the 2019-2020 season as if you selected him number one in the NBA draft. That's how I think they should go about it.
Yes, macro view. Big picture, maximize the resource. Rushing him back, even if it's like, oh, they're in a playoff run, who cares? He's not going to be a factor at that point anyway. Let him know this season you're not playing and move on from there. Because you can see how, like, in, let's say, like Marco Fultz's case, his career is at some weird crossroads now because he can't shoot.
Very much so.
It looks like he has two left hands. Like, I don't know what is going on with him. He looks like, I hate to say it, but, you know, they, in baseball, they call it Steve Blast disease, where you wake up one day and you can't throw a strike, and you know, Chuck Knobloch, Steve Sachs. It looks like Fultz is, you know, he's got the yips. So last thing you want to do is put a guy out there who's not healthy and then impact him, both get him hurt and or affect his confidence. Because Michael Porter Jr., if right, can be a special player.
Yeah, there's no question. There's no question. And I see a question on the RamosLaw.com text line, 303-713-1043. Hit us up. That is also the phone number if you want to get in touch with us on a more personal basis today, 303-713-1043. How can Michael Porter Jr. maintain his skill set if he ends up not playing the game for 2 years? I totally understand where you're coming from with that. But it's not like he wouldn't be playing basketball at all. He wouldn't be playing in games. Okay, so you allow him to slowly build himself back up physically and then reintegrate him when you believe he's 100% while still holding him out from games. So we've seen this throughout the last decade in the league. That starts with individual one-on-one work with a trainer where you're going mid-speed. And then, you know, a couple months after that, you start to play three-on-three, half court. And then they reintegrate you into drills, and then from drills back into a scrimmage setting. That can all happen this year for Michael Porter Jr. just without playing in games. I don't feel the need to roll the dice like that right now, because the payoff, if this thing works with Michael Porter Jr., it is a franchise-shifting, franchise-altering move. Your trajectory changes if this guy, who Chauncey Billups compared to Kevin Durant on draft night, works out for you. Handle with care. Fragile. Handle with care.
Oh, I thought you were trying the word fragility.
No.
I'm like, what is going on with you, dude? You have like 9 tongues? Like, fragility. What? No, it's fragility. Fragility. What? Ganali. Who? Dano. What? I didn't know we were doing this show in Italian.
Yeah, I'm trying to go back to the Christmas story there.
Yeah, I know.
I didn't ask you about this yesterday, and I should have, but we just wanted to get to so many things yesterday, and we got caught up in a handful of topics that we just rode the traction on. But Darrell Revis, Troy, and Troy Rank once again filling in for Brandon Stokley today. Darrell Revis calling it quits. When you think of Darrell Revis, what type of regard do you hold him in?
He's a Hall of Famer, first ballot Hall of Famer. He was one of the best cornerbacks in the league for a better part of 8 years. Career ended on a sour note, played terrible at the end with the Chiefs. It was a sad way. Not unlike, you know, Unitas playing with the Chargers or Willie Mays with the Mets. And, but it ends a lot of ways. Like, there are a lot of great history of great players whose career ends horribly at the end. But honestly, what I will remember about Darrell Revis is not the fact he was a great corner, is nobody gamed the system more in the NFL than Darrell Revis. He was the ultimate businessman. Every guy in the NFL gets, you know, I'll be loyal to the team, and they're never loyal to you. Revis figured it out. He basically worked on like 1 year deals at the end of his career, and he just kept getting signing bonus after signing bonus after signing bonus. So I admire the businessman. So it's more the Jay-Z, like, it's a businessman, you know? And I mean, that's
not a businessman. I'm a businessman.
And yeah, that's how he was. He treated his career as a business, and it led to him being a bit of a mercenary.
Yeah.
And it's hard to, like, who do you associate him with? Jets, Patriot, whatever. No NFL, modern NFL player gamed the system better than Darrell Revis did. And, you know, kudos to him.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because yesterday when I came in for work, I was sitting down with our executive producer here at the Fan, Raj, and basically said a carbon copy of what you said. I said I viewed Darrell Revis like two different sides of the coin. One side of the coin is really, and I'll say this, he's the best corner I've ever seen with my own eyes. He is the best corner I've ever seen. When he was at the peak of his powers, he was the very definition of a shutdown corner, to the point where his interception totals are so significantly lower than so many others who played the game, just because no one even wanted to look on his side of the field. I mean, he was that dominant. He dominated his position just as much as anyone else in football during the stretch where he was first-team All-Pro after first-team All-Pro. But the other side of that coin, Troy, like you said, is him just being the year-by-year mercenary. And when you look at how much money Darrell Revis made in his career, I'm looking at his total cash value according to SpotRack. Darrell Revis made $124 million playing corner in the NFL. Yeah,
and he's not a quarterback.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. He made quarterback money as a cornerback by going year to year, betting on himself, basically holding teams hostage to the deal, and he was so good he could get away with it. And I love that.
I mean, he got a $10 million signing bonus out of the Patriots. I mean, like...
Yeah, that never happens.
Darrell...
I would disagree with you. He wasn't the most dominant. The most dominant corner I ever saw in terms of pure coverage was Deion Sanders.
Okay.
In terms of pure coverage, when I cover Champ Bailey and Thomas Hardy, my good friends out there, and he's laughing because we had this long-running bet of the Champ Bailey-Clinton Portis trade where I didn't like it because I loved Clinton Portis, and he consistently won the deal because of Bailey's career, and he's a first-ballot Hall of Famer. I say they didn't because they didn't win a Super Bowl, and that was the only reason they were going to get Bailey. Regardless, Champ Bailey, at his height, those 3-4 years, I mean, there was no one better. No one better. But Deion Sanders was so athletically different than anyone I'd ever seen. And it's part of what like makes Tlaib so special. If he got his hands on it, there was a good chance it was going back the other way.
Sure,
and
sure.
Revis, you never feel that way.
Well,
I didn't with Revis. I'm not saying he didn't, but I don't associate him in those terms.
No, no.
With Tlaib, I did.
Tlaib, you do. Deion
Sanders, certainly I did. Rod Woodson, I did.
Rod Woodson's another one.
Charles Woodson.
Charles Woodson's another one. But here's why I say... Well, and by the way, this is a subjective hair-splitting conversation. We're talking about some of the best ever. Darrell Revis, especially when you talk about Deion and who else did you just mention there? Not Rod.
Charles Woodson, Champ Bailey.
Champ Bailey. No, well, let me just keep it to Deion then. Revis was physical.
Yes.
Like Darrell Revis was one of the most physical corners that I've ever seen.
You're right.
I mean, he would buck up. I I'm going to share with you something. I absolutely hate the New York Jets. I hate the New York Jets.
How can you hate the Jets? They never win anything.
I could care less. I hate the New York Jets. Always will. Always have, always will. And that was one guy I just found appreciating Sunday after Sunday. Darrell Revis. For my money, first ballot Hall of Famer. First ballot for you, Troy? First ballot for Darrell Revis?
Yes, because for 8 years, he was the height of his position. That's enough for me. It's a weird career because he bounced around, but it's not baseball. They don't ask you what cap you're going to wear. He gamed the system, and he played at the top of his game. He had an eight-year window where he was the best. It ended terribly, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because for 8 years, he was the best. He's a first ballot Hall of Famer. No questions asked.
Yep, no questions asked. All right, I think you're going to like this, Troy. Yesterday, I was brushing up on my fantasy football, reading a couple articles. I was pleasantly surprised by who a reputable outlet told me to buy stock in. I'll tell you which Bronco it is, but first, what's up with that Denver snapshot?